Since the tragic death of George Floyd, I've been trying to decide what to say or whether I should say anything about it. In part, this is because I don't know what to say. Little of what I've read on social media regarding the subject seems helpful to me. It's mostly a mixture of anger and guilt, with a few conspiracy theories mixed in. I've been reluctant to speak because so many others have said that silence is complicity. This rubric seems overly simplistic. It does little to help people process what has happened. Such a sentiment is merely an attempt to predispose people to a particular response. If the precipitating event weren't so grievous and the subject less incendiary, we might even call it a thinly disguised attempt to bully others into a preferred opinion. Silence in times such as these can mean many things. Silence can be an expression of grief or dismay. It can signify disapproval. Silence may simply be the response of those who don't know what to say. And sometimes silence is the disposition of the wise. For people of my age, the distress of recent days must seem strangely familiar. Smoke billows behind a rocket that hurtles American astronauts into space. Cities burn as people march in the streets and loot stores. It feels like the 1960s again, except without any of the hope. The timing of this latest crisis was also striking, coming as it did, just as some states appeared to be on the verge of reopening from the COVID-19 pandemic. Some people, whether joking or serious, posted memes that implied that the death of George Floyd was part of a larger conspiracy. I am more inclined to think that there are more ordinary forces at work. Call it sin or fallen nature. It's the principle Bruce Coburn describes when he sings, "The trouble with normal is it always gets worse." But to attribute the state of things to sin seems too simplistic. Just as Jesus is the answer to the Christian to every problem, sin is the stock explanation of their cause. The problem with this explanation is not that sin is trite. It's our view of sin that's the trouble. It's too anemic. We're inconsistent and double-minded, congenital hypocrites where sin is concerned. In his book, Not the Way It's Supposed to Be, A Breviary of Sin, theologian Cornelius Plantinga Jr. notes how newspapers and television often use the adjective senseless to describe acts of murder. Plantinga finds this description puzzling, noting that unless he's grossly impaired, every murder must have made sense to the killer at the time. He was trying to silence a witness, or gain revenge, or express his power, or act out his racist hatred, or stimulate and satisfy his lust, Plantinga writes. In a culture in which up-to-date intellectuals often drift toward moral subjectivism, how can an act that makes perfectly good sense to its perpetrator be judged senseless by outsiders? The answer, according to Plantinga, is that when pressed, even the most avant-garde observer drops his moral subjectivism, forgets all Nietzschean attempts to get beyond good and evil, and joins the rest of us in expressing shock, indignation, and the metaphysical judgment that a murder does not belong in the world, no matter what its author thinks of it. C.S. Lewis writes about the same moral sense that Plantinga describes in Mere Christianity, calling it the law of human nature or the rule about right and wrong. According to Lewis, it is most observable when people are quarreling. When this happens, two things are apparent. First, the aggrieved party appeals to a standard that he or she expects the other person to know and assumes it will be evident to them. Second, the offender almost always affirms such a rule exists by giving a rationale for their action. As Lewis bluntly puts it, the other man very seldom says, "To hell with your standard." Nearly always, he tries to make out that what he's been doing does not really go against the standard, or that if it does, there's some special excuse. In other words, our moral radar seems to operate on only one band. We are hypersensitive to the transgressions of others, but find it difficult, often impossible, to see our own. At the same time, we are also strangely comforted by the universal presence of sin. The comfort we take in knowing that we are sinners is the kind that a poor student might take, who places their trust in the grading curve. We reason that if sin is common, then we are normal. If there's anything wrong with us, we can at least say that it's only your average garden variety of wrong. Everybody suffers from it. This downgrading of sin inevitably leads to sentimentality. Sentimentality, in turn, produces superficiality when it comes to our assessment of the problems sin creates and their solutions. In an essay entitled Beauty, Sentimentality, and the Arts, Jeremy Begbie identifies three traits of the sentimentalist. First, the sentimentalist misrepresents reality by evading or trivializing evil. Evasion makes us selective in our attention. We refuse to focus on those things that are too disturbing to us. Trivialization compels us to put a spin on sin and its consequences. We're willing to acknowledge the presence of evil in our lives, but blunt its sharp edge so that it doesn't make us bleed. Second, the sentimentalist is emotionally self-indulgent. For the sentimentalist, emotion is an end in itself. In other words, the sentimentalist appears to be moved by something or someone beyond themselves, but is, to a large extent, perhaps primarily, concerned with the satisfaction gained in exercising their emotion, Begbie explains. It's enough to feel. There's no need to do. The sentimentalist is outraged by particular acts of sin, but that is all. They may even be outraged at themselves, but it's all a display. We like others to realize that we are compassionate, tender, and so forth, Begbie explains. Even if others are not around, there can be something deeply gratifying about exercising feelings that most would admire. Third, according to Begbie, the sentimentalist fails to take appropriate costly action. Begbie describes several symptoms of this pathology. Sentimentalists resist any challenge to their way of life. They're more moved by the plight of strangers than those close to them. They deal in ethical generalities like love, peace, and justice, but struggle with awkward individuals. They're impatient and lose interest when the cost of dealing with those in pain is long-term or too great. They rely on banalities and clichés. For the sentimentalist, to feel is to act. It's not necessary to go any further. All of these traits seem to me to characterize the conversation sparked by the killing of George Floyd. Actually, to call it a conversation is too generous. Social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter are not really suited for conversation. They don't lend themselves to reflection or careful deliberation. Social media is a forum for outbursts. They provide a catharsis for the one who posts, but I question their power to change anyone's mind or to move people closer to reconciliation or solution. Those are long-term, costly projects, and few on either side of the divide appear to have the patience for them. It's not silence on social media that makes us complicit in the death of George Floyd, but our complacency with sin. The trouble with sin is that it seems so normal. It respects no boundaries, either of race or economics. It ravages our lives, but remains an abstraction to us until its evil is made concrete. We only seem to recognize its true nature when we are on the receiving end of sinful behavior. If George Floyd's death does anything, perhaps it will at least enable us to imagine what it might have been like to have that knee upon our neck. What it will not do is let us know when that knee is our own. It will not tell us what to do about it. For that, we will need a more potent medicine than the accusation or guilt of social media. For that, we will need grace and mercy combined with the conviction that only comes from God Himself.